From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and let's take a ride and go coast to coast AM. Open lines later tonight. Yep, those Friday into Saturday morning open lines. I'll open up a special hotline. I'll tell you all about that later on. Well, those who were living around San Francisco had a little jolt this morning. A light earthquake. Breaking glass, jarring nerves, no injuries, thank God, reported. The 4.2 magnitude earthquake struck about 4:40 in the morning, about 2 miles east of Oakland, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. The tremor was felt on both sides of the San Francisco Bay, lasted up to 10 seconds. Residents east of San Francisco were shaken awake as pictures slipped from walls and objects, and some businesses delayed opening because of broken windows. Power out to about 1,000 customers. I still continue to get emails from people who claim to be psychic who think that the big one is coming in the Southern California area. I hope they're wrong. Well, federal investigators kind of scratching their heads tonight, examining what appears to be an inoperative military rocket launcher, a tube found Friday morning on the front lawn of a Jersey City home that sits directly in the flight path of the busy Newark Liberty International Airport. Jersey City police removed the tube, and the incident is now being investigated, of course, by the Joint Terrorism Task Force and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. There was no evidence of any explosive device discovered at the scene. And a Patriot surface-to-air missile has been found in a Florida scrapyard. Workers at the yard in Tampa called police to say they found a torpedo. Experts were drafted in from the nearby MacDill Air Force Base, who quickly identified the object as a Patriot. They said it was harmless. It was missing its warhead. President Bush has signed an executive order prohibiting cruel treatment, including humiliation or degradation of the religious beliefs in the detention and interrogation of terrorism suspects. The White House declined to say whether the CIA currently has a detention and interrogation program, but said if it did, it must adhere to the guidelines outlined in the executive order. The order targets captured al-Qaeda terrorists who have information on attack plans or the whereabouts of the group's senior leaders. President Bush will undergo a routine colonoscopy Saturday and temporarily will hand presidential powers over to Vice President Dick Cheney. Mr. Bush will have the procedure done at his Camp David, Maryland retreat. Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, and three of its executives have been ordered to pay a $634.5 million fine for misleading the public about the painkiller's risk of addiction. A U.S. district judge levied the fine, saying that, well, they should have been able to tell people about this. The hearing included statements by numerous people who said their lives were changed forever by the addiction to this drug. On July 20th, 1969, the human race accomplished its single greatest technological achievement of all time when a human first set foot on another celestial body.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Ah, yes, the voice of Neil Armstrong. I was 19 years old when I saw that, heard that. I'll never forget it. I had a great opportunity to meet Buzz Aldrin during our Larry King interview last week. That was quite a thing. And several months ago, I had an opportunity to interview Buzz Aldrin here on Coast to Coast. And we just talked with him about some of the events on the moon landing, what he had to do to help get that lunar module back up. He had to play with a pen. Hey, that's right, a writing pen in order to kind of circuit something to get it going. Well, here's our discussion with Buzz. Buzz, it is a delight having you on the program, sir. How are you?
I'm very fine here in the southern coast of France and Saint-Tropez. It's just beautiful here.
I had heard that you got the name Buzz because your sister couldn't pronounce brother when you were a kid. Is that true?
That That's the way I understand it. That's the way they keep telling it to me, yes.
And then you legally changed your name to Buzz, right?
That's correct. I guess maybe 20 years ago, probably. But it takes time to catch up to all you journalists.
Buzz, I've got to ask you, whenever you look up at a full moon, do you sometimes pinch yourself and say, I was there? I mean, what's the feeling like?
Well, I guess I coined the phrase afterward that before we went there, it was a stranger, but it's a friend now. That's kind of, it's manufactured after the fact, and that really doesn't mean a whole lot. It's not too habitable a spot either. It's going to be difficult for people to go and live there for a long period of time. And I understand all these technical things about it, but I guess I'm still enthused whenever I look up there and realize that, by golly, I have actually been to that place. Now, it's not as clear as it used to be. I have a little astigmatism. But, you know, we all have to live with growing a little bit older and having a few aches and pains and popping a few more pills than maybe we used to. But it's really amazing that there's still 18 of us still alive of the 24 people who reached the moon in support of those six landings.
And all heroes. When you were on the moon with Neil and you two are bouncing around there, I mean, it had to have been such an incredible feeling. You're looking at planet Earth. You're on the moon, desolate. I mean, what kind of a feeling was there, Buzz?
Well, you got one of the two words. I just put two words together that seem to describe the event to me: magnificent desolation. And Tom Hanks has used those words now in his latest 3D IMAX portrayal of the six missions that went to the moon and what the guys did. And he put it in a perspective of young kids kind of asking a few questions and being asked questions and coming up with childlike answers. And then right near the end, why one of those girls who was asked questions turns out to be the base commander of a rather extensive base on the moon. Now, that's, I think, really a wonderful setting for an outstanding portrayal of the achievements of getting there on the moon. I just feel that that's outstanding. I'm not sure that it reflects the reality of an expanding human base. My vote would be that we would have an expanding colony on the surface of Mars for a number of reasons. It's much more habitable there. The resources that are there at Mars are much more capable of supporting sustained human activities. It takes a long time to get to Mars, and you need to gradually build up. You can't bring everybody back on a return trip, so other people have to stay there. I just vote for a growing habitation on Mars, and I think we really have to commit to that before we start spending a lot of money directed toward specifically Mars. I think we're doing the absolute right thing now in setting our objectives, as Kennedy did back in 1961, really. It was the first time he said, we're going to go to the moon. That was May 25th. Yuri Gagarin had flown once around the Earth,
right,
and Alan Shepard had gone up and down just 15 minutes in flight. So to look back on those historic times is really quite a privilege for all of us. 12 walked on the moon, and 9 of us are still alive. And I'm trying to bring those people together in an Apollo Lunar Ambassador reunion.
Oh, that would be a great reunion. I've got to tell you. Are you disappointed that we stopped going to the moon and the program just seemed to end?
Well, my participation in it ended. All three of us, Neil, Mike, and I, decided that being so privileged to be on that first landing that we just would forego the opportunity to stay in the crew rotation cycle, and we'd move on to other things. And we all did that so that other people could have their chance to get to the moon. Neil went into aeronautics at NASA headquarters. Mike worked for the State Department for a while. I had hoped that my return to the Air Force, the first astronaut to do so, would be as an assignment commandant of cadets at the Air Force Academy. That's kind of an assignment that would allow me to ease back into the service after being away for 11 years out of 20 years. But that wasn't to be. They asked me to command the test pilot school, which was unusual because not only had I been away from the service for a good while, but I'd never had any test pilot training. I eased my way into the astronaut program by the academic achievements at MIT.
Buzz, I was reading in a documentary that you're going to be in that it was pretty touch and go trying to take off from the surface of the moon. There was some kind of broken circuit breaker, and you had to use a pin in order to really punch it and ignite the LEM. Is that what happened?
Well, we have rows and rows of circuit breakers, and we use them to protect a circuit from being electrified early when it wasn't really needed. So we sort of have a double protection. Most aircraft do that. If we're not using something, let's say you're flying cross-country in a fighter airplane and you're not going to be using the guns or rockets, you pull the circuit breakers on that so that just in case, something might jam or might fire if you happen to have ammunition aboard. So a lot of circuit breakers were pulled. And evidently, when Neil and I got back in again and then sort of moving around to take those backpacks off in confined quarters so that we could depressurize again and toss those overboard to save weight for liftoff, we really put all of those kind of things into the flight plan to give us that extra assurance that we'd have enough fuel to more than get in back into orbit. Evidently, in doing that, I had knocked up against some of the circuit breakers, because when we finally got ready to try and sleep, I chose the most likely spot, got my firsties in there, and that was to lie down on the floor. But as I got ready to do that, I noticed that amongst some of the lunar dust on the floor, on the edge, was a broken off circuit breaker.
Oh, no.
The top of it. So I thought, well, this might be the lighting circuit breaker or something else. But I looked up there, and it was the engine arm circuit breaker.
Oh, no.
So we reported that to Houston, and then those guys were up for the next 6 hours trying to figure out how to get around that circuit. If in some eventuality, when the time came to arm that circuit, that it didn't stay armed or something like that. So they finally concluded that instead of waiting until 5 minutes before liftoff to push it in, we'd do that about 2 or 3 hours after we got up, which is what we did. And of course, not wanting to maybe apply any metal to that, why I chose a pen that we were using that had a felt tip. On it, so that it wouldn't
short out.
And when I pushed it in, of course, it stayed in, so I didn't have to act like the little Dutch boy and hold my finger
while you were leaving the moon. And that's Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, of course. He got out of the limb right after Neil Armstrong plopped down. They piled up 46 pounds of lunar rocks, put it back in, and they took off. And he just told you how they were able to. And let's not forget the command module captain of Columbia, Michael Collins, who was patiently orbiting all around the lifeless moon, waiting for them to come back. 38th anniversary of the landing on the moon. We'll have a hotline during open lines later just for this. I'll tell you why when we come back. Now, the organization is still trying to prove that the Earth is hollow. Dr. Brooks Agnew, our guest, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, our guest for the rest of the hour, and we'll take some of your phone calls a little bit later on, Dr. Brooks Agnew has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's degree in statistics, a PhD in physics. He was a featured scientist in the 1997 Wendy Robbins documentary on HARP called Holes in Heaven. And Dr. Agnew has recently co-authored a landmark publication on the creation of the Earth, The Arc of Millions of Years. His website is phoenixsciencefoundation.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And he's back to talk about this expedition. Hey, Brooks, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, George. It's great to be back.
Good. And I'm going to be with you, by the way, the end of August or so at the Bay Area UFO Expo.
That's right. That's right.
Look forward to meeting you face to face. Well, give us an update on the exploration plans for the Hollow Earth.
Well, we just got back from Tibet. As luck would have it, we had an opportunity to go to Tibet with Maureen St. Germain. It was a small group, and she was going in the back country, which is where we wanted to go. We didn't want to go to the main tourist sites. So March 29th, I joined this small excursion, and we took off. Now, this was not a pleasure trip, but it was absolutely an adventure. When we landed at 11,000 feet in Tibet, it's quite a shock to the biology, to the physiology of a human being.
Oh, yeah.
You walk very slowly because this is the point at which we would normally use oxygen in a small aircraft, but you don't have any such luxury up there, so you really have to take it easy while you acclimate. In fact, we had several of our team that caused us quite a bit of problems with altitude sickness the 19 days we were there. And 11,000 feet was the lowest we were at. We went all the way to 17,500 feet. Anyway, while we're touring the backcountry, all the normal tourist sites that you normally go to, the Chinese have controlled Tibet since 1959.
Yes.
So they control all the tourist sites, and they charge you for photographs, and they guard all the things that are really valuable. And we had a great Tibetan guide. I can't tell you his name because it would get back to him, and he'd have some problems.
I understand.
His life there. This Tibetan guide took us to a place in the Patala. Now, the Patala was the world's tallest building until about 100 years ago in Tibet, in Lhasa. So we're walking through this magnificent structure, started in the 7th century and completed in the 17th century. It's kind of added on. But down in the bowels of this building are said to be some very great treasures. So each time we go there, this Tibetan guide asks the Chinese guards if he can go past the locked doors and go down into the lower parts of the Patala. And over the years, they've told him no all the time. But suddenly, this time, for no reason at all, they said yes. So the Chinese guard opens these double doors that have probably been closed for 40 years. And our group, I can't even tell you how many of us there were, because that would get the guide in trouble as well. We slip past the doors, they lock the doors behind us, and we start down this spiral staircase into this exceedingly dark area. We're just barely able to see our way. We get to the bottom of this spiral staircase, takes several minutes to walk down in there. You step off the last stair onto a polished stone floor, which contains what we would in modern times call a swastika. But in those days, it is a symbol, a cross, an ancient cross, probably one of the oldest versions of the cross, a symbol of the union of the polarity, just like we had.
True. Until the Nazis screwed up that logo, that symbol, it was widely used many years ago.
Yes, exactly. And in the middle of this was about a 2-inch turquoise. So it was a really neat. So I stood on it, and I turned, and as my eyes adjusted, I could not believe what I was looking at. There in front of me, 20 meters high, out of over 4,000 pounds of gold and covered with over 10,000 jewels, was a Tesla coil.
A Tesla coil. Stay with us, Brooks. More to talk with you about and an update on your Hollow Earth trip. There's some pictures he sent us that are up there at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back. Ah, yes, and also with Ian Punnett, because Ian's on Saturday nights beginning at 10 p.m. Pacific time. And who do you have on store for us this weekend?
Well, first, let me just say thanks again for doing that tribute to Art. I think that was really nice of you. Did you have a good time with that?
I did. I had a great time also listening to those old clips, because I had not heard all of them over the years, obviously. And it was just neat. It was exciting to hear those things again.
Well, and what was your favorite story you think about Art that you didn't know about before?
All of them.
Well, I won't put you on the spot to choose one, but I enjoyed it. So
they're all good.
Doing that.
They're all good.
It's sort of weird that they should both fall on the same night. It wasn't an intention, but tomorrow night we have Deborah Jean Palfrey, the woman who is currently being accused by the government of being a madam. And the woman who had the book that she was attempting to sell and all the names.
Right.
She's going to be on with us for the first hour.
Well, I know your name and my name, they are not in that book.
It's funny, though, that there were several people who were relatives of mine who passed on years before I was born, and they appear on the list.
Oh, so, really?
But they had, there's something going on. And she wants to talk about what's really at stake, what's really at work. And she'll do that coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. And then also Colleen Raleigh, the FBI agent named as Woman of the Year, considered a hero by many for what she tried to do to stop 9/11. She wants to talk about what we need to do to stop another one. And she's got some secret stories that you'll pass along tomorrow and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM.
That sounds exciting, Ian. And ask her, too, about the search for bin Laden, because I'm hearing from some of my sources that they are getting very close in that Pashtun area near Pakistan, Afghanistan, that they're getting close to Zarahiri, but they think bin Laden may be with him if he's still alive.
Yes, good question, and I'll be happy to. That'll be tomorrow.
Okay, thanks. That's Ian Punnett. That'll be Coast to Coast at 10 o'clock. Now, we'll be back in a moment with Brooks Agnew as he talks about updating us on the search for the hole to see if Earth is indeed hollow. And welcome back. We're with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Brooks, a Tesla coil, you find?
Yes, and, being the only physicist, at least the only one that would admit to it, in this room, I recognized what I was looking at, and I said, okay, let me count the coils. So I counted the coils, and it matched up. I counted the base of it, and it matched perfectly. And I thought, holy cow, this thing was built in the year 746. How did they know about a Tesla coil, and what does it have to do with Tibetan Buddhism? Well, the Tibetans call this a stupa, and they use it to transport the soul of a Panchen Lama or a Dalai Lama through a four-dimensional stargate.
Amazing.
It's amazing because this thing's painted on the ceiling. I have a picture of it below the two pictures that you have on your website, just so people can get a close-up of it. And for those people that have recently seen the movie The Last Mimsy, these mandalas of these stargates really resonate with people. It's just got a natural resonance, and it's said that if you just keep looking at them and meditating on them, that you'll actually reach enlightenment. This is what the monks do all the time.
Well, what are the possibilities, Brooks, that this search for the hollow earth may be really a dimensional portal?
Well, it gets stronger and stronger. The very symbol of Tibetan Buddhism appears to be a hollow earth. You can see the foliage on the outside, and then there are seven rays of light, and on the very inside is a yin and yang. So it looks like a hollow earth. And as I went around and used my translator to speak to various monks at different monasteries, each person kind of gave me a piece of the ancient story. It appears that in the 7th century, the King Gampo had conquered 9 nations, one of them being China. Now, we don't know if it was completely by force. Some of it might have been by diplomacy. But instead of enforcing Tibetanism on them, because they didn't even have a written language at the time, he married 9 princesses and had them bring part of their information to him, and he formed Tibetan Buddhism out of whole cloth and the Tibetan written language. In this formation, he links the human being to the inner earth, and the whole religion is an entire male-female relationship that works just like the union of the polarity we outlined in our first book. It could not have been more synergistic with our mission, which is one of the reasons we went there to Tibet, because the roots of the inner earth story come from nations as old as Tibet. And it is said that Tibet, especially the Himalayas, are the root chakra of the earth. So all of these things tie together and tell a story, and that's why we produced the video, the Expedition Inner Earth Expedition Part 1, which is for sale at Amazon and on our website as well. And all of this Tibetan footage, including film from inside this area, is available on that website. And I guarantee you this film doesn't exist anywhere in the West.
Now, you were going to be going on an expedition aboard a Russian icebreaker. How's that coming along?
Well, that's coming up next summer. We are chartering the Yamal, which is a nuclear-powered Russian icebreaker. It's the only ship on the planet that can make this trip that's civilian. Military ships can, of course, do it.
Well, the way things are warming up, you might not need it.
Well, actually, as luck would have it, the area we want to go has been locked under ice for about 200,000 years. But due to global warming, we can now get through to this area.
Uh-huh.
Now, some even stranger things happened this last week. I'm walking in the town of Weed, California, because I spoke at a convention there in Weed, California, and will again the week right before the UFO conference in San Francisco, where we're going to be. And on a park bench, there's a box, and it says, free books, take one. So I looked in the box, and inside was a 1952 edition of Funk and Wagnalls Encyclopedia, the A volume. So I reached in and opened it up, and I said, hey, let me just look up Arctic. So I looked up Arctic, and I started reading through it. And this is something I actually didn't know. But the person that discovered the magnetic North Pole was Sir James Ross, the Scottish explorer. Happens to be my great-great-grandfather.
Ah, the synchronicity's too much here, Brooks. Too much. I love it. Let's take some calls, as promised. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Just wanted to say that I really appreciate everything you're doing and all your research. And quick question, just wanted to know if you have any thoughts or comments on the correlations with in Tibetan and Indian cosmology in general, like the Asura demons and the different levels of demonic beings, and some of the correlations with like the inner earth. And you definitely spoke about that a bit in like the city of Shambhala and in the Kala Chakra Tantra in particular. And if you have any thoughts maybe on if there are any geographical correlations to the stories of like the Devas and the Asuras, the godlike and demon-like beings, and maybe if you think they're in any positions in particular. I'll take my answer. I'm sorry about that.
All right. Well, see the best you can do on those questions, Bruce.
Well, I think we need to bring him on the expedition with us. It sounds like he's a very good expert in a lot of this Indian and Tibetan lore. Actually, I'm just now learning all of that myself. When I went through Shigatse, there's 108 rooms that actually make up a building that is a mandala, and you walk through these 108 rooms and meditate on exactly what your caller was just talking about. All of these beings that are involved, not only in the creation of planets, and especially the Earth, but the alignment of the Earth with the human soul, and how integral the human soul is with the actual creation of the Earth. So, George, when you asked your question earlier, is the opening into the inner Earth possibly dimensional? We are preparing for that. One of the requirements that we have in putting together our 100-man science team, we're not picking just any 100 scientists. Anybody can do pH measurements or salinity measurements or magnetic measurements on the Earth. These people are going to have to be able to achieve a level of consciousness they're not used to, because it might be a requirement to get this gate to open up.
Fascinating. If you get it to open up, what are you going to do? You going in it?
We're not going to go in it. That's part of our charter. We're not going to take a 450-foot-long, 23,000-ton nuclear-powered icebreaker in through a hole into the inner Earth. We're going to wait by the hole. And if we're in the right place at the right time with cameras running, and by the way, we're going to be broadcasting live on the Borderland Network so people can watch this just like a reality show. What we see, they will see. And if something comes up out of the ocean or a hole opens up or the fog parts and we're able to see through into this Shambhala that your caller mentioned, everyone's going to see it with us.
Do you think our government, governments that have satellite capability, are aware that the Earth might be hollow?
Well, funny you should say that, because in February of 2006, our government passed the Data Denial Act, which allows the government to block real-time footage or any feeds from our polar weather satellites above the 60th parallel, and that goes for the South and North Poles. Right now, there are no publicly available images of the North Pole anywhere. Now, Google Earth has some animated ones that they say are built from satellites, but those are animated. The feeds above 60 degrees parallel are not real.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, is it me?
Yes, me. If you are who me is, you are.
Okay.
Welcome, me.
I just want to make a comment with all due respect. I've studied a lot of Tibetan Buddhism and Chinese Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitler did take the swastika, and he, you know.
Yeah, I think the Tibetans had it first.
Yeah, the Tibetans, that symbol was reversed. And that stand, it's not a cross, it's a symbol for the Milky Way galaxy. It has nothing whatsoever to do with any cross. The first civilization that had a cross-like figure was the Celts.
Actually, it's found in both directions, clockwise and counterclockwise. And since the Earth is not from the Milky Way galaxy, I really don't think it correlates with the Milky Way galaxy.
Well, regardless, what's the point?
Well, I was just curious. That's the first time I heard that it had to do with a cross. When, in fact, my Lama teachers and other Buddhist teachers, monks, I've always asked them that question. You know, this looks like the swastika symbol. And they said, no, it is ancient Buddhism, and it's a pictograph for the Milky Way galaxy. And I thought that was very interesting.
That is interesting, but it predates Buddhism by about 3,000 years.
Next up, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George. Hello, Brooke. This is Mark from Albuquerque.
Hey, Mark.
Brooke, I met you up at the East City Conference over the 7th.
Yes, Mark, with your lovely daughter, Mariah.
Yes, how are you?
Wonderful.
George, you had put up one of the pictures, my picture that you put up from there was mine.
Oh, okay, sure.
That I had submitted, and I just wanted to call in because I support Brooke and his mission, having listened to him. And he is going to be successful. It's part of the awakening process for everybody.
Well, if the hole is there, he'll be successful. If it's not, I don't know what are you going to do about that, Brooks.
Yeah, we'll just film a lot of whales and ice, and we'll sing a lot of kumbayas. But I kind of have the feeling, George, that we were invited.
How will you know you're in it?
Well, that's a good question. Scientifically, what we're going to be doing is searching for what's called the Oceanic Depression. It's a place where sea level isn't sea level. Many of the Russian mariners report that occasionally it feels like they're sailing a little bit below sea level, which means that there is a gravity anomaly there where the sea actually dips down like a bowl. Now, there's no way to measure this except with a precision gyroscope. So we're going to have one on the ship, and when we go over the edge of this depression, which you won't be able to see from sea level because you only have about 8 miles of perspective due to the curvature of the Earth, but we will start sailing at right angles back and forth across that until we get enough of the circumference that we can calculate the diameter, and then we're going to sail for the center of it.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Evening, George.
Hi.
I really don't mean to throw a damper on the expedition. I think it's an absolutely wonderful thing. And, you know, being a science fiction and fantasy buff, I would think that it would be absolutely wonderful to make such a earth-shattering discovery. But with all respect, you know, are the governments of the earth actually going to allow anything to... if there is anything there, actually to let it be broadcast or let, you know, the normal little peons like us know what's going on?
Well, I think, what was it, 3 weeks ago, George, that the Russians declared that the Arctic area was theirs? I think they just put their flag on it and decided that they annexed it.
I guess that means the moon is ours.
A very valid point. Governments may... prevent civilian access to this area. But since there are four polar voyages a year with this same ship, and they just go a different route, I don't think that they even believe we're on the radar, honestly. I don't think anyone's going to try to stop us from doing it. I don't feel anything like that. I don't have any fear of that. Here's the bottom line. We sit in our universities and our labs, and we say we know the way the Earth is built. But when we look at the data from satellites, from seismographic data, all kinds of strange sea life that we're netting that we've never seen before, we don't know where this stuff comes from. We don't know why earthquakes reflect the way they do around the inside of our Earth. The pictures don't look right. They have all kinds of dotted lines and recalculations and fudge factors. But when you picture the Earth as hollow, everything fits. Everything works. The bottom line is, no one has ever gone. So we're going to mount this expedition. We're just going to go and see for ourselves so we know once and for all.
I bet you would have loved to have talked with Admiral Byrd many years ago.
Boy, I would have loved to have interviewed him.
My gosh. Well, you know, I think he did see something. I don't know what it was, but I do think he saw something.
Well, he only spoke about it orally. He never wrote it down. I don't think that his diary is authentic, but it's an extremely curious legend that is built up around his flight in 1926.
Yeah, you might be right about that. Let's go to one more caller, Brooks. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, take it away.
Yeah, George, pleasure to be on the show. I just have a question for your guest. If and when this opening does open, does he have any concerns that he's not going to have a choice of whether or not he can stay out of it, so to speak, if he's invited into it beyond his will?
Well, I don't feel that either. All of the historians that we have on our crew and the people that have done research about this, there are no reports of whole ships disappearing in this area. Now, there are people getting locked in the ice, and there are people that get lost. There are people that don't find their way and don't find an opening. They get blocked out by fog or by ice or by high winds. But that kind of thing hasn't happened. And if I could tell my whole story, which if you want to know it, you can, of course, watch the DVD that we have out. It's part one of this. You'll know that we kind of feel like we're invited. And there are many, many legends and predictions and prophecies that around this time, right before the end times of 2012, a reintroduction of the life that's on the inside of the Earth will be made with the life on the surface of the Earth.
Brooks, I want to thank you for giving us these updates and great pictures that we've got up there on the website that you got to us.
My pleasure, George. Anytime.
All right, and I'll see you at the Bay Area UFO Expo in a few weeks.
That's right.
And I'll be back in a moment with Open Lines. I'll have a special hotline for you, and the rest is all up to you. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.